Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2677. That's 2677. Tonight we have Lori Golden on, and she's a psychotherapist, and she's working with other trauma victims and survivors. And she says that she's a survivor herself of incest, and she was abused by her father. But I'm not going to tell her story because that's for her to interject. Tonight is question and answer, okay? So if you have any type of question that you need to have answered about flashbacks or how you are dealing with stress and all this other stuff, please do call in because she is here. And, you know, this is a good thing. So there isn't anything that we survivors don't know about. You can't shock us. There are many people who listen through the computer. I know this. And if at any time you want to, you know, come on live air and be a part of the panel, please feel free to. The number here is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. I'm Carol Levine, and I am Vice President of NASCA. And that stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, and that's what we are. We do have a mission statement here, which I will go over, and hopefully someone out there other than what we have here. We have three people right now, that's myself included. But, you know, don't feel bashful about calling in, okay? Call in, or at least listen, you know, if you want to call in and but not listen, or not talk, that's okay too, because some people just simply are bashful. But I always say to you, if you can talk on the phone, you can talk on the radio, because that's the way it is, okay? Okay. First of all, we have a singleness of purpose at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways. Number one is educating the public. And we're going to be start doing that again because it looks like in all the different states, although some are a little bit behind, New Jersey is still a little behind, of course, but it's getting a lot better. We will be out there speaking. I have a couple of places I have in mind. But anyway, number one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic, a worldwide problem that affects everyone. Number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Prevention is one of my most favorite part of those three because I feel that if we work harder in our communities, I believe in that, we can help, you know, you educate the communities. That's what we do. And also going into other places where they allow for you to come in and speak about child abuse. If people are more educated, the adults, the parents, the good parents, okay, as I call them, the normies, whatever, you know, they can educate their children. And believe me, pedophiles do not like educated kids. They'll walk away and they'll find another child because that's what they do, okay? So we do a lot more than that on NASCAR. If you go to our website, which I'm very proud of, that's www.NASCA.org. That's NASCA.org, okay? If you go there, you will see a whole list of programs that you can get involved with and all different kinds of information right on the front page, right on the front page. And you'll see a picture of Bill, and you'll also see a picture of me. I didn't know he was going to do that. I'm inside of Centenary University there, I think. I think it was Centenary. It could be Sussex, too, because I went to both. But it was mostly Centenary giving a presentation. But anyway, the point is you learn a wealth of education, all right, just from our website. And this is what we need. We, the people, are going to be the ones who are going to help make the change. And that goes in all different areas of concern of what we're going through today. Okay? You have to understand that a lot of people out there are just public servants, and they have far too much power. And I'm not talking about the police department. We need them. All right, that's the end of that. I will say no more because this is not a political show. But I could probably talk for 2 hours on politics. Okay. So anyway, Lori, let me ask you something. I mean, I think we have Lori, we have Mark, and I guess it's myself. I thought maybe that the Pamela was on, but maybe not. I'm going to give you the number again. It's 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. And what I'm going to do then is start asking Lori some questions. But before I do that, I'd like to know if she has anything that she would like to discuss.
Yeah. Hi. How are everybody? Or how is everybody?
well, we're here.
I would like to talk about this topic of codependency. It's a big word, and a lot of people, I have a lot of clients that come in as, you know, people who have survived sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, neglect, who have lived in a lot of fear in their childhoods and are absolutely they're codependent in their relationship, as I was in my relationship. And it's very misunderstood. And people seem to have a hard time understanding what this is. A lot of times I'm asked, I have to really work on explaining what codependency is. A lot of times in relationships, you know, when I work with partners and they'll say, well, I'm just being nice. Does that mean I'm codependent? And there's just a lot of talk in 12-step programs as well as in, you know, my practice with survivors. The topic comes up because it affects us in relationships. In personal relationships, in family relationships, in love relationships, in friendships, in work, it affects all areas of your life. And I just wanted to...
I think it's a very good topic.
You,
where's my mouse?
Did you want to ask me?
here it is. I found it. No, actually, I like that topic. Okay, that's good. I always have a lot of information for things that can be used, you know, but I do more for, you know, for the institution I work with, you know, like over at colleges and stuff like that, and when I do presentations. But this is a good topic because codependency is something that so many of us go through. I mean, I went through it. I mean, there's probably a lot of people, You know, why do people go through codependency? Because at one time in their life, they were made to feel like they couldn't stand on their own. All right? Maybe they weren't smart enough, or they wouldn't be able to handle, you know, life and life's terms and so forth. And then, you know, you just wouldn't be able to support yourself, or certainly not someone in your family. Now, this can be male or female, all right? Usually it's the females that, you know, are more codependent, and they're put in that position many times, not just by family members, but many times by the spouses that, or spouse, I say spouses, I had spouses, you know, that they choose from. And they feel like they can't, you know, keep up with, you know, with the household. That's one thing. You know, I wouldn't be able to make the same amount of money as my husband, who passed away almost 4 years ago now in September 7th. You know, because he was an electrician for the New York City Housing Authority. Oh, yes, he was. He was a very smart man, and he was part of 9/11. He was in that area because that's where he was working from, in that area. And he got cancer and he died. Now, he always made me feel like I wasn't as smart as he. And I feel today, you can't do that to me, all right, because I feel good enough about myself where, look, I have expertise in some areas and he has expertise in other areas. And that's fine. That's how we're supposed to do, you know, and be. But we're supposed to complement each other, you know, to support each other. That's for a good relationship. But in the relationships that we choose, because we don't know how to choose properly, and I certainly didn't, I chose people that would attract me because they were so intelligent. They were, you know, such go-getters, you know, and all this other stuff, and they were out there, and they had self-confidence, which I lacked for many years of my life. And many of us lack that. Because we were always downed as a child. That's where it starts. A lot of our problems do start at home. Correctamundo?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know if you were going to say more at that point.
Right.
You know, Carol, what I like to do in helping people understand codependency is how does it develop to begin with? I mean, what are its origins? And when I think of codependency, I think of being focused on another person and not on yourself, and losing yourself because you're so focused on other people that you don't even know what you feel. And think you it's called in one way people pleasing, but it's more than that. It's based in fear, and I know what I remember about my childhood and what I wrote about is I was so focused on my father, who was my abuser, because I was terrified. I felt like my attention was on him the moment he came home. And I would be up in my bedroom and I would, let's say, be trying to read or trying to study. And my attention was not on what I was doing. It wasn't on myself, it was on my father. I was always focused on him. And so I thought that if I focus on him, if I give all my attention to where he is in the house, then somehow I can get safe. But I never could get safe because that's not the way we get safe. But my focus was out onto him not on to my own feelings. Same with my mother. I focused on her and what she was thinking and what she was doing, not on myself. So I grew up really not knowing what I thought and how I felt. I didn't trust myself because I never focused on myself. I always focused on another person, and it started with being abused and having to live in terror and having to make sure I knew what my father's moods were going to be like, and was he in a certain kind of mood where he would come to my bedroom, or was my mother lying about something or acting as if she didn't know what was going on. So we develop in fear a keen sensitivity to another person, to their behavior, what they're doing. So, for instance, when I, let's say, got older and I got into a relationship, I was completely focused on my partner, pleasing him, making sure that he was okay, doing whatever I had to do to ward off any possible fight with him. If he was in a bad mood, I'd focus on that mood, and I'd try to do things to get him in a better mood. I wouldn't sit with myself and say, how does his mood affect me? Because I didn't think it had an effect on me. I truly didn't realize that. As simple as that is, I really didn't recognize that my attention was so focused on him that it was never focused on me. Mm-hmm. So I could tell you what mood he was in, but I couldn't necessarily tell you what mood I was in. I could tell you what he probably feels, but not what I feel. And, of course, I always was – codependency is kind of couched in being very nice and very pleasing. And so you're doing for other people, and you think that that doing is actually a nice gesture, when in fact it's self-serving. So I remember coming into my 12-step program and getting off of drugs, and I would say, I've always been a good person. And I thought about all the things that I would do for other people and almost be selfless. And in doing that, I was really operating from, if I can make you feel good, then I'll be safe. Or if I can make you, it was always, my focus was always in trying to be safe. That was my main issue in every relationship I was in, is how can I be safe? And I wouldn't actually ask myself that question. It wasn't until later that I understood that my focus on other people was because I was afraid. I was either afraid of their reaction, mostly of their reaction, or if I didn't know how they were going to react, that uncertainty would fill me with fear. And I just tried to be very pleasing to people. And it was a rude awakening to realize that my pleasing behavior was actually very self-centered. It wasn't about pleasing another person. It was about warding off my fear. So I just wanted to say a little bit about that. Do you have any response to that, Carol?
Yeah, I do. At one time, I mean, now today I'm different, okay. When I do for
right.
people, it's because, yeah, when I do for
it's
someone.
It's different, right.
Yes. It's out of love, okay? I mean, there's certain people in my life that I really, really care about. I really love them, and I will do for them, and it makes me feel good. It makes my heart feel good, okay? But years ago, when I was with, you know, bad partners, and even in my home when I was living with my mother and stepfather, I would try to go out of my way. I would go out of my way to try to please them, to earn their love, okay? To earn their love. I'll give you, for instance, I came from people always who owned a florist business, started many years ago. And even with my mother, with her first husband, her husband was very abusive to her. He was abusive to me in the sense that I watched all the beatings he gave my mother. That's trauma. Good God. Blood flying, all this other stuff. And so I would, at the age of 4, which, believe me, I suffered from, because I went and took one of his bottles and I smashed it. You know, he was an alcoholic, raging alcoholic. A piece of glass came up and chopped my nose off. Well, yes, it did. I've got the scars to prove it.
Wow.
And I thought, well, this will help. You know, at the age of 4, I was trying to help the situation, right? So I walked into the house with my nose pushed up to my face. And I said, hey, Ma, I cut my nose. And when I took my hand away, she shrieked. We had this doctor down the street. And he had more than just a regular office. He had updated machinery that I'd never knew about, certainly. I wouldn't. But the adults didn't even know about. Anyway, they put my nose back on, thank you. And it took quite a while. But, you know, I threw up from the anesthesia. He gave me so much. He gave me so much. And it went down into my lungs. And I almost died because the machine that I'm speaking about, one of them, that's brand new, they were so scared in the office, they forgot to plug it in. And it was to suck out debris or vomit, if you will, from the lungs. That was part of the reason why he had that machine. Well, I turned purple. I had no air going through me until they realized they hadn't plugged it in. So I had to stay there for many hours. It was sort of like almost like a tiny little hospital, if you will, because no other doctor in that area had the equipment this man had. But I'm very thankful that he had that machine. Now, what was I doing? I was 4 years old, and I was trying to save my mother from being beaten, and I feared it was the alcohol, and it was those bad, bad bottles that were, you know, causing the problem. So I was being a people pleaser in the sense of taking a bottle and smashing it, thinking, well, if he doesn't have this bottle, then he won't drink it. And I was trying to please my mother. So it kind of started at a very early age, okay, very early age. And then too, that went out, you know, I was always trying to get her love, never really had it. She never loved me, that's all right. And that father took off into California, and that was fine because he was a maniac. So my mother remarried. So I tried to help him in the greenhouses. He bought a greenhouse place, too. I always had people that were very wealthy. Did me no good. But anyway, okay. So I would try to work with him to try and get his attention and to get his favor and to get his approval. So when we would have terrible windstorms, and greenhouses in those days were made out of glass, honey. You didn't have that plastic stuff like we have today. They were made out of glass. So I learned how to cut glass. And I would hand him pieces of cut glass. I'd measure him and hand him the pieces of cut glass, trying to gain his favor, being a people pleaser, to make him happy, to help him. So I understand a little bit of what you're saying, because I did that throughout my marriages too, until finally one day I said, hey, you know what? I'm a person too. And I started to get, you know, I started to reason differently in my mind, especially after a comment my second husband made. He said to me, I wish you would get a backbone. You see, he wanted to fight, Lori. He wanted to fight.
Yeah.
And I would not fight with him. Only makes matters worse. So as long as he didn't hit me, and at times he did hit me, believe me, fool. But the point is, I would go throughout the course of my day, whether I was working or not, because I would work off and on, always throughout social services, and I had worked different times and so forth. But I always made sure that no matter, you know, if I was going to come home late the next day, maybe I had a meeting after my shift. And so I'd make sure that dinner was made the night before. And then when I would come in, I would make sure that, you know, all I had to do was warm it up and it'd be something good, you know. And I would make sure that I did the laundry and no help from him with anything. Keep the house clean, keep the kids going, make sure that everybody was taken care of except for me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Being
so you see,
really
I think
good
that's what
caretakers.
We do.
Yes,
yeah,
we become caretakers, and
mm-hmm.
and but we don't focus on what we need.
No.
I do now, of course, and of course, you know, that started changing as soon as I got into recovery and at 37 and started having my memories for the first time of sexual abuse with my father. So I had to learn how to focus on myself, not another person. And boy, Carol, I worked so hard in my relationship because I kept trying to figure out what were they thinking, what were they feeling, what do they need? You know, always focus so much on them, and it's impossible to figure out what another person needs. They have to tell you. They
right.
have to tell you what they need. But in codependency, you're always trying to figure out what does this person need? What can I do to make it better for them? How can I, you know, get them to do something differently? If I can only get them to do it differently, then I'll be okay. And it was never about what do I have to do differently to make myself feel better and to be safe. And so when I started understanding that it wasn't about the other person, it was about me. And what do I have to change about myself in order to feel differently? Instead, my focus was on, if I change you and stop you from doing what you're doing, then I can be okay. And there's no winning in that one. It's you're often feeling like you're working really hard to get love, to be in a love relationship. And
yeah.
It's, I think the greatest gift I got from my sexual abuse recovery and
mm-hmm.
my 12-step recovery is keeping the focus on me, and that I'm trusting that you will keep the focus on you. And if you don't keep the focus on you, well, that's okay too, because I'm keeping the focus on me.
Right, right. I
couldn't even draw boundaries with people
mm-hmm.
because I was so afraid to say no or to not ask for what I needed or believe that anything I needed would be too much.
Mm-hmm.
So I never drew boundaries. Even though I was uncomfortable about something, I would go in my head and I'd go back and forth. Am I uncomfortable? Should I be uncomfortable? I would get so lost in my thinking that I would not feel the discomfort anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you can relate to what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, completely. I think I did that for most of my life. Like, it started at a very early age, like at 4, and then again at 6. My mother dropped me off at this place that I had to live in for a year and a half, and he was a pedophile. Okay. Well,
nothing like feeding you to the wolves.
Oh, I was fed to the wolves, believe me. Yes, I was.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point is, the minute my mother, I didn't know these two people very well. They were like distant family members, okay? And they were very old. They looked, of course, when children are little, people look old anyway. You know, if they're 30 years old, they look old. But these people were old. And they weren't playful. They weren't joyful. And every time this guy, which I didn't see him only but 3 times, every time of those 3 times, he'd look at me and he'd smirk. He'd get this weird-ass smirk on his face. And I would feel myself bristle. I was already afraid of him. I don't know what it was. You know, they'd say that, like, dogs can sense certain things and cats. And,
well, it's
well, some
the way
little kids.
He was looking. Yeah.
Yeah. So can kids. They can sense certain things. So
kids know when an adult is creepy, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you believe me, this is the last person that I wanted to be dropped off with, he and his wife. No way. And they didn't even ask permission if I wanted to stay there, okay? I was just plain dropped there. And I remember my mother made me come into the house, and I looked at those two people, and I saw a rag on the counter. It was a wet rag. And I don't know why I did it. I immediately started to wipe the counters, wipe the drawers, you know, like where you put silverware, that type of thing. And I was stopped, and this aunt, who would be a distant aunt of mine, she was like a great aunt, said, "Why is she doing that?" And so my mother said, "Well, I really don't know." But in my mind's eye was, I've got to make these people like me.
Yeah.
Okay. Otherwise, I think I'm in trouble because of that man. I mean, he wasn't blood or anything. But I'm in trouble because of him, okay? So she then took me upstairs, and no bath, no nothing that night. And I had a lot of that going on after my mother left me there. No baths during the week, thank you very much. But I was put into bed, and I was holding on to my mother, and I was screaming and crying. I said, "Please don't leave me here." And she just was very cold and took off.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say it was about maybe a week later, maybe 2 weeks later, the sexual abuse started with this monster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you see, I didn't try to make him like me. I was scared to death of him. And there was nothing,
right.
There was... Yeah, it was all volatile. There was nothing good. You know, he wasn't trying to make me like him or anything. It was sex. It was raw. And he didn't enter me because he knew that I would bleed. I was only 6 years old. But he would get on top of me and and ejaculate that way. And I wasn't allowed to take baths, Lori, until Friday.
Yeah.
Which meant
mm-hmm.
I went to school Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday with no bath. So I would go into the bathroom and wipe myself the best that I could. I was just a little kid. I did the best I could.
Right.
And then on Fridays, they would let me, when I came home, they'd tell me to go upstairs and take a bath because, you see, my mother might show up on Saturday because she was paying them to take care of me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you see, all right, in the beginning, the very beginning, though, I tried to please this great aunt of mine to have acceptance from her. So we do this in
mm-hmm.
relationships. We do this. And it doesn't get us anywhere, you know, many times.
No.
It really doesn't.
No, it
doesn't.
All it does is attract people who want to take.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Often, a person who wants to please attracts somebody who more or less wants to take what to please who's giving them.
Yeah. Yeah, I've learned that the hard way with over the years, you know, with friends, with family, you know, things like that, because I had so, I felt so dirty. I felt so, you know, I had such low self-esteem, such
yeah.
terrible low self-esteem. And I think, you know, with kids, when they, you know, come from terribly dysfunctional homes and they see horrific things, you know, the mother and father killing each other and all sort of stuff. And,
yeah.
yes, I think that, you know, this is what happens. And my brother, who was 5 years my senior, he was the prince. Okay, to me, he was the prince of darkness. But that's what he
right.
was to me. But to my mother, he was her pride and joy, and she didn't care if he was sexually abusing me. That was started at age 9 with him. So you
yeah.
see, when you go through life, you try to please people so that they'll like you better and you'll be accepted, and then that love is supposed to come bouncing back, and it doesn't. And I know this.
No, it doesn't. It
no.
doesn't, because there's an endless kind of pleasing that you do, and all that it does is make you feel more unloved, because
mm-hmm.
you think you're giving, and I'm so giving, and I'm giving, and it just makes you feel worse about yourself, ultimately.
It can. It absolutely can. Now, I've learned who to give to today.
And that's
I,
a
you
different
know, some,
issue.
Yeah. But, you know, even I even have to watch myself, though. I have to watch myself. Like I have a gal friend, we'll call her a gal friend, that I've given a tremendous amount to because she has so little, right? And but I have to put my brakes on and have my boundaries, because as friendly as she and I are, I've known her for 17, 18 years, something like that, I can go overboard with her, too, but I don't have to win her. You know, friendship, it's very solid. But it's because
mm-hmm.
I did so much of it throughout my life,
mm-hmm.
I sort of like fell into a pattern or something, you know what I'm saying? And
yeah, we do.
So,
we're conditioned.
Yeah.
It's a really strong conditioning. And we
yeah.
do it as a knee-jerk reaction. There's no thought in it. There's
mm-hmm.
just, we just go into doing something as a way to try to get love.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what a sad thing that is, okay?
Oh, there was so much grief that I felt when I started understanding what I did in relationships with people. I felt so sad for myself that I couldn't ask for anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I really couldn't. I didn't feel deserving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I couldn't ask for help. I mean, when I was, you know, when I was in my 20s, I took an overdose of pills, and I was sitting by a phone, and I had my hands on the phone, and I thought of these different friends that I could call, but I couldn't call anyone because I just didn't feel deserving of asking for help. And, you know, instead, I opted to take the overdose of pills as opposed to ask for help. And, you know, it's so much our self-worth. I mean, how do you have self-worth when your needs are being ignored by your parents? You can't.
Right.
You can't
no.
feel good about yourself if someone isn't helping you to feel good about you.
Mm-hmm. That's so, 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 so true. The one thing that I did have more than not, I mean, I went through a short period of time where I didn't have friends in school. Okay, that was in between different places where I lived, and I don't know, I moved, I was pushed around too much to live here, to live there, whatever. And so I didn't have any friends in the one place that I was living at. And that was not good. I didn't have any, even that, okay? But I did have friends where I, other places that I lived, and quite frankly, they were so dysfunctional too. We were like the rejects, but we didn't care because we had each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And we would take care of each other, whatever our needs were, if we could. I mean, we're just, you know, teenagers by that time. I'm talking about teenagers. And, you know, so, but we knew we had each other, you know. One girl did turn out very, very, she did try to commit suicide. But then I did, too, when I was 17. And with my mother telling me to do it and do it right, that's what I had. And in her case, she was in the military. They had signed her in. Never spoke about this one. She was had signed her in, and I guess she was so unhappy about being in the military instead of, I don't know, you know, she should have been happy. She got what she wanted. She thought that's what she wanted.
Right.
And she got in there, and she tried to commit suicide. So, you see, so often, you know, we are so horribly unhappy and sad because we go through this emptiness, this hole in our heart. I don't know how to tell you this. We're educating those that are listening. And this hole in our heart, you know, that there's something missing here. You know, I used to be like a people watcher. I'd watch and see what, how other families would be.
Yep.
And I'd think, wow, I didn't come from that. And it didn't matter whether they were rich or poor or in between. Maybe back then there wasn't in between, I don't know. But it didn't matter because, you see, they had something that I didn't have, okay?
Or something you thought they had.
Well, they certainly appeared happy.
Of course. Everyone appeared happy to me as a child, too, except me.
Oh, that's true.
I did the same. I mean, I looked at other people and their lives, and I thought, you know, they were happy. And then I'd go home and just feel, you know, I don't even think I connected with unhappiness. I connected with terror.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
that was the predominant.
This is Bill Murray, and I'm here because I saw there were only a couple of people here. I decided to call in and join you, maybe help out a little. So if let me comment on what Lori just said because I agree with you, Lori. You know, I looked around and I didn't really weigh how other people were feeling. To me, that they were okay at least, you know. But I tell you what, I was desperate. I was desperately lonely, and alone, and confused, and hurt, and you know, so there was a huge dichotomy between how I felt and whether I even knew other people felt. But I knew what I felt, and I couldn't get out of it. So it was desperation time. Maybe that's kind of being a sociopath has to do with not being able to empathize with other people. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Children are sociopathic. and, you know, when it's true, and when something like this happens to us, you know, we have the same experience that it's very common. We might be expressing it now in our adulthood and differently, but we feel different and separate and unique, and injured and desperate. You know, we just don't know how to get out of it. I was so lonely, you know, in my misery. I was miserable, I guess I'd say.
Yep.
So anyway, I thought I'd jump in and add that, Lori. Thank you for being here, by the way. We love you.
Al, thank you for being on. How are you, Bill?
I'm okay. Having some computer problems tonight, and that doesn't make me happy, but personally...
How do you like living in L.A. now?
Oh, you know, I've lived here forever. I've lived here since 1980.
Right, but you were in you were in Florida and then came back to L.A. Are you?
Well,
does it feel good?
A better question or a better way for me to respond is, how am I feeling about having definitely left Florida? Because I was going back and forth for 15 years or more. I've resigned to being in California, and it's not so bad. You know what I mean? Actually, it came down to my wife and I were talking about where are we going. I wanted to consolidate and could have done it in Florida or here. And she decided she would rather be here. So I said, okay, we'll do that. So that's how it transpired. But it was an awful lot for me to try and split myself months at a time between one coast and the other. So how do I feel about having given up Florida? I feel fine. You know, I like I like my little house and my wife and dog, and you know, the neighborhood knows me very well, 25 years. So can I say something about that is important, Carol, that I want people to know?
Sure.
Yeah. Posted a new article on the front page of the website. The article does display well. What's not displaying well, and I have to figure out how to fix, is those pull-down menus in red. But I will figure that out. But there's an article there, and it's entitled Back to Business. And if you haven't seen it yet, I want people to know that what I'm talking about is I was invited on Saturday to speak at an event next Saturday, the 12th. So that kind of spurred me to think about it, an article like this, where I'm encouraging us to get back to business in the sense that, you know, the COVID crisis is winding down as a crisis, and as more restrictions are being relaxed, depending on where you are, of course, it's going to start to be possible for us to go back out in the community like we used to do and haven't been able to do in a year and a half or 2 years. So what's back to business is to go back out into the world and start now to plan events for the late spring and the summer, and let's get back to, you know, doing that part of our mission, because, you know, it's half our mission to educate, and plus when we go out and do stuff in public, we're always rubbing elbows with newcomers and old-timers. that's a big part of our mission. I just feel, and I'll stop talking, but unless you want me to give you more detail, but the point is that there's nothing like rubbing elbows with your fellows, right? And whether it's talking at a university like you do, Carol, and there's a picture of you on the article, by the way.
I saw that. I look very Irish. Go ahead.
Being invited to speak at a park, which is what I've been invited to do, that's perfect, you know. It's outdoors. There's very low restrictions on any outdoor stuff, and even if it's, frankly, someplace where you still have to wear masks, I say wear the mask and do the event. At this point, we kind of understand that, you know, and many of us are willing to take the risk. Many of us have had the shots, so... the point is that, you know, whether it's tabling, which I know you also do, or it's an event like a march or a benefit, we could start thinking about benefits again. You know, let's get out there and start putting calendar events on our website and, you know, encouraging people to participate. This is for local stuff, obviously. But we want NASCA to be engaged in local stuff. I mean, we are local to our own communities, even though we're national in scope and international in reach. So anyway, thank you, Lori, for letting me butt in there with a little bit of extra stuff.
Thank you.
Well, you know, it's true. You know, it's things are happening now. People are looking forward to getting back to the new norm or to just plain normal, for God's sake, all right? And I, for one, am one of those people. And so I'm starting to, I have two places, they're churches actually, where I might be able to, I do well in churches. I do well in universities too, but I do well in churches mm-hmm. also. And which is unusual. I don't go in the Catholic Church. I'm Catholic. But I've gone to other churches. They're non-denominational, all right? They don't care if you're Catholic or what you are, okay? That's not the point.
Well, but the point is there's lots of opportunities, but we have to create them now because,
mm-hmm.
you know, or be willing to participate in others, which is what Saturday will be for me. I didn't create this event,
mm-hmm.
but...
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's a local group, a nonprofit, that basically raises funds for helping kids, you know, and
mm-hmm.
especially kids who were trafficked in the past. So that's right up our alley. I said, sure, I'd be willing to come and represent NASCA and give a talk and wear my T-shirt and so forth, but it's for them. I mean, it's not for us, but still we're carrying the message, and that's our mission.
Yeah.
You know, then there will be times, Lori, when we'll want to do our own events, you know, under the banner of NASCA, so to speak, or attend a conference where you can put out a table with literature and whatever it is. There's many ways to engage with the public that we have not been able to do, you know, in this long period of time, nearly 2 years, I think it's been since we really were active.
Because the last time we were able to do it was...
Yeah, it's too long. So,
yeah.
You know, we've done well with substituting Zoom, but I just don't think there's anything like rubbing elbows with each other, you know?
Right.
I agree with that, Bill.
I agree.
And that's, yeah, I want to get back into that. But, New Jersey is a pain in the neck, okay? I can't go into New York City yet because there's too much riding in there. There's still too much trouble. And
it's going to depend on our membership where they live. Some people's
mm-hmm.
restrictions are going to be lowered quicker than others, and that's fine. But they're starting is the point, and we should start
they
too.
Are. Yes,
you know,
you bet your sweet ass. I want to get out there. You know how I like to talk, Bill. I'm as bad as you.
I bet my sweet ass, Lori. Did you hear that? That's a Carolism.
Okay. I like
right.
to tease them a lot. We go back and forth. We like to tease each other. But I think the time has come now. It's we the people, okay? We the people. In a lot of different ways, and I won't get political. But I'm going to say this. It's time now, yes, to get out there and to do what we do best. And that
is,
you know,
politics.
Like a
it's
lot
healthcare.
Of us, not all of us.
This I'm not coming from a place of politics at all. I'm coming from a place of healthcare,
that it was
wise to stay at home, to... monitor
we
your,
had to.
Your, who you're running into, to not go to events, to wear masks, to get shots, to all of that stuff. But now they are actually starting to let some people, for example, eat at restaurants. They space the tables out. You know, you could do a banquet if you spaced the tables out enough, probably in some areas anyway. But you could certainly do anything outdoors almost everywhere. And frankly,
mm-hmm.
even if you gave the restriction to wear masks, even if it's outdoors, people would do it. So I think it's time to start thinking about it because, you know, to plan an event like this, you have to do it in advance. You have to do
mm-hmm.
it like 3 or 4 weeks in advance to be able to really roll it out. So now's mm-hmm. the time to get busy and back to business is the point of the article. Right, Mark?
No, I agree with that. And I'm looking forward to it, to be honest with you. Because, you know, it has been like almost 2 years. And all of a sudden it came in and boom, I wasn't allowed to go to I had a church that I was going to speak at. And I wasn't allowed to go there because of the COVID. There you go.
That started about
2 years. About 2 years ago. Yeah.
But you guys are talking...
Mm-hmm. All right. You guys are talking about churches and mm-hmm. my brother-in-law is 60 years ago. He was molested for a year with a priest, mm-hmm. and he is now has a lawsuit. He's suing
wow.
the Archdiocese of New York. Isn't
Good.
That amazing?
Yes.
I'm so
too.
Happy. I love.
I do too with New York because they just allowed people who were beyond the statute to have it.
Yep.
It was originally a 1 year. They extended it to two. I got in there. So I have a suit
mm-hmm.
pending
yeah.
there, and I have another one pending in Pennsylvania. So I got two of them.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I want to make a statement that it extends only until August.
If you get your foot in the door before August is the point. So
yeah.
you have to bring your suit now, and then however long it takes doesn't matter. But you do have to bring it now.
Yeah, yeah.
Good for you. I'm glad to hear that, Bill.
Yeah, Bill. When did you do a lawsuit against the church?
Well, I pursued the priests that were my molesters several years back. I pursued them, and I found that in one case, the statute of limitations criminally had not run out because it was in Maryland. There is no statute in Maryland for criminal. But the guy was in his 80s, and he lived in San Diego, and they weren't willing to extradite him back to Maryland to stand trial, so he got away with it criminally, at least at this point. However, he also molested me in New York because he was also the event that happened to me was at a summer camp in Maryland. He was a school teacher in Brooklyn, and
mm-hmm.
he took me to Brooklyn, to New England, to Montreal, and so forth. This is when I was kidnapped. Well, I have mm-hmm. a civil suit against them now because the part that opened up was New York. So since he's a teacher in New York most of the year and some of the molesting happened there, that's why I was able to sneak in under their new statute. Then in Pennsylvania,
wonderful.
I had notified, and that one, by the way, involved the FBI and the local attorney general and all that, and they did a really good job tracking this guy down because I didn't know where he was. And found him and talked to him at his front door in San Diego. And the decision was made in Maryland that they couldn't risk at his age to have a heart attack on a plane coming back handcuffed. So they didn't. But if he was ever stupid enough to step foot in Maryland, he has a warrant out for him because of me criminally. But he's now also facing a suit, and so is the order he belongs to in New York State. And the other one's Pennsylvania, where I identified two priests out of a bunch, and I wasn't absolutely sure of the names of the rest of them, but two of them, I knew their names, and the two of them were reprimanded. One had already deceased, but he got a reprimand in his file, and the other guy was denied us with a loan. He couldn't take a car out. He couldn't be alone with anybody. He had to go out with a partner. And he died recently. But for a period of time at the end of his life, he suffered that. But in the meantime, you know, again, there was no criminal statute that I could follow, but there was a civil one. So I filed mm-hmm. one against St. Vincent for the two priests in their names. So, you know, you got to...
So
on top of where you were molested is where it matters. Oh, go ahead.
So the one in New York is still outstanding?
Yeah. The criminal is outstanding too. That's in Maryland. But the same man molested me in New York, and that's a civil case.
Right.
Because it's under this change in the statute that came along a year and a half ago and got extended to August. So wherever you're molested, just let me say to the listener, that's where you have to bring the case. So the state that you were molested in matters a great deal as far as whether you will be able to bring a case, but we are trying hard, various survivors, to change the laws all over the country. And this is an example that worked in those two states, Maryland and Maryland had already changed it, but New York was terrible. It was draconian.
I know.
And Pennsylvania was much better. So both states, though, relaxed the statute, and in New York State, it was a temporary relaxation for anybody who was still beyond the statute, which, of course, is the category for your brother-in-law and me. We're over 60. And I think
well,
in New York,
now
you
have
25 years or something.
Yep. Let me say something here. Okay. Now, with the churches, I have a reason for the churches, okay? It doesn't matter whether they're Catholic or what they are. Or even, you know, they found out whether even with the Jewish, the Hebrews and all that other stuff, well, those churches, whatever, the synagogues.
Synagogues. Right.
It happens in every single religion is my point. And every single one of those religions, they have youth groups, and that's my concern. So, but I will stay away right now at this point from the Catholic. I want to say one thing. Some years ago, Bill, probably around 4 or 5 years ago, 5 years ago, I was along with Sandy, and we went down, and we were we were almost rioting, but we weren't. We were protesting outside of the courthouse because of Sheriff Bullock. Now, Sheriff Bullock would go into detention center at nighttime, and he would drag out little boys, and he would sexually abuse them. And he would, you know, threaten them that if you, you know, tell on me, I will make sure that you never see your family again, or you'll go into foster care and it'll be an awful foster home. He'd tell them all kinds of stuff. And then he'd give them a candy bar. Now, he got away with this for years. And then all of a sudden I was contacted by someone who was a survivor of this sheriff. And this happened in Warren County, my county, where I live in right now, right? This happened, though, years ago. Now, all of a sudden, about 5 years ago, I did get, this letter and an email, and they asked me, please, to help. So I went down there, and who is it that works on the statute of limitations from Naskagan? I always forget her name.
Mercy Hamilton's so, one of them. She
Yeah. She was inside the courtroom. And this guy, mind you, I saw him being wheeled into the courtroom because he was 84 years old by this time. Because, unfortunately, it takes for we, the survivors, not me, I have a big mouth, but, you know, but with a lot of survivors, it takes until their 40s and or 50s, whatever, to come forward, you know, and tell on the person. But a lot of people were starting to gather, and they were the survivors, and they were outside, and I was with them, and I was carrying NASCA, a big NASCA sign. And other people had made their own signs, and they were very creative. Now, unfortunately, they didn't make a decision that day, but he was to be, you know, he had an ankle bracelet on, and he couldn't leave the house and all this other stuff. And they had him go to another county because so many people had gathered. You know, there were people that were gathering outside and were taking interest in what we were protesting about. I didn't care if he was 84 years old in a wheelchair with an oxygen tank. He did the crime. You do the time. I don't care if it's only 3 weeks before he died. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yes.
And then you know what I'm saying. We survivors feel this way.
What I'm saying is he was eventually chastised and he died. He's dead. He's dead. My guy is not
dead. He died. Yeah, he died.
I know.
So the next place that he was taken to where they did try his case, where they were going to try his case, yes, he died before. So he didn't do one day in jail. Not one day.
But you know what I'm more interested in? What happened to
what
all the pornography? All the pornography? The guy who lives in San Diego, he left the church maybe less than 10 years after I was molested by him, maybe 5 years, and he eventually married and so forth. So he had a secular life for most of his life, his adult life. He's the one that, you know, also was the photographer and took many thousands of pictures of me as a little boy, you know, that were pornographic in nature, all of them. Or he, mm-hmm. he gave some legitimate ones to my parents, which is why they knew him and were kind of grateful to him. They didn't know. There were 10 times as many naked pictures taken of me. But that's what I'm most interested in. First of all, I want the guy embarrassed. I want him dragged. I do. But this was a decision that Maryland made because they'd had a bad experience with somebody who sued them later for suffering on the trip that they made him take in old age back to their state. So they didn't want to do it again. And I'm disappointed in that. But what I'd really like to do is find out what happened to the pictures. Where are the files? Where are the negatives? What, you know, and so forth. Because that's still a kind of a overhead embarrassment for me, you know. I don't walk around with it. I'm not ashamed of it, but still, you know, it's a big deal for him.
The idea that somebody could have a picture of you as a child in their possession, that's like, yeah, that would feel, it's not that you walk around with it, but it's, you want it back, you want to get rid of it.
Yeah.
You don't want somebody to have those pictures of you.
Exactly.
I wouldn't want
and
that.
Let me make one more comment. My abuse happened to be through the church. The original guy from Maryland was a brother. He was from one organization, one order, they call it. And the other two were priests from another order. But as Carol said, it just happens to be that they were priests. No matter who abused you, and I'm saying this to the listener, maybe it's a school teacher. You know, maybe it is a law enforcement person. Maybe it's a neighbor who was kind of well-liked in the community. Maybe it's a businessman who, you know, had some authority and power downtown or whatever it was. Maybe it was your uncle. It doesn't matter. These statutes of limitations are for everybody. They're not just Catholic, in other words, is what I'm saying.
No.
If you were in the Boy Scouts, you know, in the church, in the girls' camp, you know, wherever it happened, and you have an opportunity to report the crime because the statute is available to you, I beg you to report it, even if you don't think you're ever going to get anything out of it. Here's why. It's really important for us to try and get statistics that are accurate. And the only way to do that is for reporting to go on. Even if there's no further action taken, that matters.
That's exactly right. I had a conversation with someone.
That's where we get to say 1 in 6 boys or whatever, because that's how many have reported it. It's not how many have been abused, but it's dependent on the reports, even if they happen 20 and 30 and 40 years later, they get entered into the database,
right.
and you get counted, in other words. I'm sorry, Carol, go ahead.
That's all right. I want those scumbags, I'm going to call them scumbags, off the street, okay? Because I had a conversation with someone. Oh, well, I'm mad. I could say worse words. No, I won't
I know.
Do that. But you know the point.
Yes,
the point is this.
Bag works.
But anyway, the point is this. You know, sometimes a lot of people think, well, let me do street justice. I had that happen in my case with one time. But last time I was raped, I was 17, and I got pregnant. Thank you very much. Oh my God in heaven, and I had a miscarriage. Now I had no one to go to. My mother would have killed me. She was so is my fault. But anyway, the point is this. What we have to do, street justice is a nice, sweet thing. However, it doesn't stop the pedophile because the broken bones, they heal, okay, if you don't kill them, and all this other. We need to get them off the street. So if you want to get a punch in, excuse me, I say okay, but one punch. But call 911 for God's sake and get them off the street. That's so important because otherwise it's just going to go on and on, you know.
Well, I'm not in favor of that. I'll just say that I don't believe in
vigilante
justice. I do believe in having the cops go. You know, in that Maryland case, they found out who he was. I didn't know his real name. I knew his religious name, but they figured it out. Followed him around in his various places he'd moved and figured out he finally settled in San Diego, the other side of the country, and they had two FBI officers go and knock on his door. And
yeah.
he came to the door, and they told mm-hmm. him why they were there. And mm-hmm. I don't know, I mean, that's, at least he was alerted to the fact that he was found and his past crimes were known. Now, they did not extradite him. But
mm-hmm.
I don't know if, you know, that's pretty severe, having two FBI people come and talk to you at the front door of your house. I don't know if that stopped
yeah.
him. I don't think it would. I doubt it would.
Mm-hmm.
But at least he knows that we know, and I know, who he is. You know, that, I don't believe in punching people, but I do believe in setting the cops on them. Absolutely.
yeah.
Well, listen here. I'm at the point in my age, man. If somebody came after me, I'd punch him, and I wouldn't care.
I know.
No more abuse. No. I wasn't put on this earth. I said this to someone not too long ago. I wasn't put on this earth to be abused by anyone. None of us were. So,
no.
If someone, you know, if someone got a punch in, I wouldn't care, but you have to call 911 and get them off the street. You have to get them inside the prison. And you know what?
Yeah.
There shouldn't be any, keep them out in regular population because everybody's got a niece. Everyone has a daughter, a granddaughter, a nephew, whatever the case might be. Because don't forget, it's not just little girls that get abused. It's boys, too, like Bill. You know, and you have to understand that they feel the same way that women do. As they grow up, it goes into adulthood until you get help you need. They suffer the same way. It's just that they have to man up, okay? So they're not supposed to act like someone who is abused, and they have to watch their P's and Q's more. That's just the way it is, and that's not right, and it's not fair. Today, things are changing because we're having – look what happened last Friday, Bill – we had how many guys on the show? Was it four? Something like that. And they happened to pull in.
Because they came in from the leader of the group let them know that he's going to be on, and they followed him. And that's great, you know.
That's wonderful.
It was a very good show. Yeah, it was a
good
show.
Yes, it was. To have all those men come on, it was wonderful. And, you know, I want guys to come forward. And come December, we should do something, I think, because that's supposedly the month we're supposed to look at the men, you know, who are little boys who were abused and all this other stuff, and have someone order. Hell, I'll do it. I don't care. We'll have a show, you know, just for men only to speak to their hearts, to speak to their minds, because there's a lot of guys out there that never told anyone because they're still too ashamed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's
a shame right there. Yeah.
But here's the thing, you know, as far as vengeance, I'm
mm-hmm.
not talking about if somebody is attacked now.
Mm-hmm.
What you can do now that you couldn't do when you were a child is you can prepare now. You can take self-defense classes, which I've done, and I've had my
mm-hmm.
wife do. And I don't know how well I would do. But I know I would be active, and I know certain things that would be very effective to harm somebody if it was
mm-hmm.
an event that was going on then. I'm just saying
mm-hmm.
vengeance, which is going back into the past and punching somebody out, I don't agree with. But I have no problem with you, especially if you're not attacking somebody, but instead you're defending yourself or your wife or your girlfriend.
Bet. Yeah.
Defend
mm-hmm.
yourself.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And learn how to do it now.
You know?
I mean, I took classes for several months, and every now and then I go back for refreshers, and so did my wife. And we basically learned something that was kind of like a jiu-jitsu type self-defense that a friend
mm-hmm.
of ours taught us. And we attended his classes. And he and his wife hold these classes, and we attended them. So anyway, I have no problem with people defending themselves. I just don't
no,
think
absolutely
we
not.
Ought to attack. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
No. You know, I want to say when I got into, in 1987, when I got into my, when I had my first sexual abuse memories with my father, and 2 years later, I don't know if you know the guy, the lawyer, Andrew Vax. He was in New York City, and he really started writing about child abuse and family, you know, incest. And I remember I called him, and all I wanted to do was take my father to court. And it just, I was too vulnerable. I was in the middle of D, and I was having heart, you know, very scary memories. But, and in 1993, my father died, but I would have loved to have taken him to court. I really would have. It would have been, it would have been just a great experience for myself, but I couldn't. I couldn't do it at that time.
You know what?
So
it's
I encourage people.
I was in my early 20s, perhaps, mid-20s maybe, living in Brooklyn Heights, and I was accosted by a guy who walked up to me. I was sitting on a park bench. He walked up to me and asked me if I had a light, you know, and then he sat down next to me. And for all intents and purposes, it looked to everybody who was walking by, because it was a public space at dusk, basically, like we were having a conversation, but he said, "I got a gun in my pocket and I want your money." Well, I wouldn't do it. And he stood up, and he got more and more angry as I refused. And somehow I believed at a certain point he probably didn't have a gun in his pocket, and I jumped him. And we rolled around on the ground and punched and kicked and fought and so forth, and the crowd gathered, didn't know what was going on. But in the middle of it, he jumped up and ran. Well, I called the cops, got in a cop car. There were like three or four cop cars going up and down in the streets of Brooklyn on sidewalks and everything, and we caught him. And when, you know, months later, we went to trial, and his mother came over, and he, too, was in his 20s. And she said, "I don't understand what happened, but I hope you don't testify against him, because Johnny wouldn't do something like that." That's what she said to me, appealing to me.
Yeah, of course.
I said to her, "Sorry, but Johnny did do it, and I am going to testify." And the guy got 3 years. You know, so you got to stand up. This was not about sexual molestation. This was just, you know, a mugging, right? But, you know, and they never found a gun, by the way. We don't know if he had one or not, but he didn't have one by the time that cops caught him. Anyway, he got 3 years because no gun was found. But still, I was hurt. I was angry. I was shocked that somebody would try and take advantage of me like that. And you know what? I made him pay the price. I made him pay the
price. There you go.
And that was
there you go.
Yeah. So absolutely, I have no problem anybody following the system. I just don't want them to take the system in their own hands. That's all.
Right. Well, I think that when we're, you know, when we're out there, and especially now, look what's going on in the streets, Bill, with people getting bopped all over the place. Come on. If someone comes after me, first of all, I don't go out of the house unless I have a weapon on me. That's it. I don't mean a gun. I mean other kinds of weapons. But anyway,
yeah,
the point
like
is if someone,
spray.
You know, like, look, you can use your keys in such a way that they can be a weapon if you know how to do it right.
Yeah.
But I also have under four fingers. That's the law. I know the law. And that can do an awful lot of damage if someone is trying to take you down. But I feel that I have that right to defend myself. We all do.
You do.
And if someone's
you
going to, if someone's going to, whether they're trying to rape me again, who the heck knows, or take my purse or just beat me up, I don't know, I'm not going to just stand there. I won't do it.
No.
And we shouldn't have to either.
I have a cane between the front seats of my car, you know. And I drive around with it, and I hope it's within easy reach if I ever needed it, you know? So you have to be self-conscious too. Am I looking like a victim is a big part of it, because that's what that's what criminals are looking for. They're looking for, just like we say, the predator is looking not for the quarterback. If they're the coach on the team, they're not looking for the quarterback. They're looking for the guy who wishes he could be the water boy on the team, right? They look for the weak one.
Yeah.
They do the same thing with us walking around. And they gauge their ability to get away with something based on what they perceive as the weakness of the potential victim. So be aware. Walk straight. Look around. You know, notice things and so forth. That's all important to avoid being a victim. And if you are a victim, absolutely you fight back. Absolutely.
Well, you know what? It's the way you carry yourself too, Bill. You know, I don't think anyone would approach me now, because I'm just plain, I'm too tough at my life. And I think that's what's kept me going for so many years, you know, is because I am a rough person. Now, I'm not saying that I would never get, you know, attacked. Don't you never know if you're going to get attacked. But I have a way about me that I am going to punch back. You bet. And I think you have that. I think people can sense that about me. They can.
Well, I know when I'm walking, at night, and, you know, or, I mean, I have a guard dog as well, but if I'm in a parking lot, let's say, and I'm walking to a store, I have my thumb ready to go on pepper spray, and you really do portray a different energy, you know, than being scared, looking around, and being, it's so different when you're willing to, help yourself in that way. It's very different.
I have pepper spray also. The only thing I'm afraid of is bears. That's it. Around here where I live, we have them all over the place.
I can't believe you still have bears.
You don't. And that's somebody you don't attack. Don't attack a bear, please.
No.
No, you don't.
No.
Bears are very strong, and they'll win. They'll do some damage, even if they run away.
Oh, yeah, no, they're more than damage. They'll eat me up or something. I'm afraid of them. I'm scared of them.
No, they don't eat you up. They cut you up is what they do with their claws mostly. Mark,
the only good bear is a bear rug. I used to have one. It was beautiful. Go ahead. But I had a beautiful bear rug. I did. Oh my god. No, But well, we had an interesting show.
Let me get Mark on.
Excuse me.
Yeah, I'm glad you're doing that. Yeah, go ahead.
Excuse me. What was the question?
We were talking about being attacked by bears. I wondered if you had any around you.
Oh, well, there are been said to be bears in Louisiana, but mostly we got raccoons and opossums, which they are pretty nasty-looking characters, and skunks. In fact, we just had a skunk get killed out on the road right in front of our house, and, of course, we're 100 feet from it, but you can smell it. But that's the only kind of critters I saw around here. We had a fox every now and then, but... And there's like coyotes in the distance down in the valley. You know, they hoot and holler some nights. You know, they're always in a pack, though. I never came across any of them, but that's basically a lot of deer. We got a lot of deer down here, but, you know, mostly soft valley.
It's unusual to be attacked by a deer, but I was once attacked by an elk. Who was protecting her young, and I didn't see the baby.
Right.
I was out with a camera shooting, you know, wildlife, and I came upon an elk. This was in Maine. And I was getting a good shot and everything. All of a sudden, she ran at me, straight at me. And I fortunately was able to step aside behind a tree, and she was giant. You know, she was giant. She was as big as a horse. And then I saw she had a baby. She had a baby behind her. And which I had not seen, and that's why she did it. But we were talking about defending yourself, Mark, and we got into animal defense. We were really talking about defending yourself from predators, men, mostly predators, of the human persuasion. And that's how we got into this topic.
I'm always on the lookout, you know, when you're with, if we take our grandkids somewhere, I'm always watching. Of course, they're never out of my sight, but I'm always checking out someone who might be standing close by, you know. And then same with Pam, too. I'm always, you know, right there. You know, I don't think she could defend herself that well, so I'm always looking.
Yeah, she's
following. Well, you know, you have to watch your children. You have to. Look, let me tell you something really quick because the show's almost over. But when I was 4 years old, we were down in Coney Island, okay? And Coney Island was much nicer when I was 4 years old. But anyway, we were in Coney Island. And the adults were so busy talking that no one was watching me, all right? So this guy comes over to me. He takes me by the hand, and he took me over and got me an ice cream cone. He bought me an ice cream cone. And I remember him taking his hand all over my dress. Now, this is what I remember. And he was saying, oh, it's a nice dress, but it's a little wrinkled. My mother wouldn't have put a wrinkled dress on me before going out somewhere if I had a dress. But anyway, the point is I had one. And so he put his hands all over me. But I don't remember anything other than that. But he took me back. And then my mother looked at me and she said, who is that man? I said, I don't know. So she looked up at him and gave him a nasty look and he walked away. Well, what if he hadn't taken me back? See, that's the point. When you, right. You just said something, Mark. When you're out with your grandchildren, everyone has to have their eye, okay, on the children. It's nice to have conversations. It's nice to enjoy the weather. It's nice to be outside. It's nice to talk to people and all this other stuff. But you have to keep your eyes on your children because they're not after you, those type of people. They're after that little kid.
Yeah.
That's right. So I'm glad that you do keep your eyes out, you know, watching. You watch out for your grandchildren. Absolutely.
And Bill, I do have a 2 foot long thick piece of stick in my truck.
Ready to go. Yeah. Well, Lori,
that'll work.
It sounded like a great show. I really appreciate your being here again. Thank you.
We had a very good show. Very good show.
Thank you.
We're talking about codependency, and that's a very big issue with a lot of people, mostly women, you know, mostly, who are so codependent because they've been made to feel less than. So then, therefore, they feel less than, and then they're always trying to please someone, try and get that person or persons, it was my family with me, to like me, to love me, to accept me, all this other stuff, and in my marriages, too. So that's a big topic.
Let's give Lori the final 30 seconds or a minute to say some final comments, can we? Because we won't see her for a month. I'm not going to miss her.
I just hope that anyone listening, either if you aren't at the place to go to the, you know, to the police or bring a case against somebody, just telling somebody about your abuse is where it all starts. And I just encourage people to talk about their abuse to anyone that they feel that they can trust right now. Because I think telling is without question, it's the first step in coming out of secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have much to say. Other than I think telling on our abusers is a big deal.
You bet.
That's where
you
it's
bet.
At.
Oh, well, we couldn't agree
Amen.
More with that because it's step yes, that's step number one. So anyway, we had a good show tonight. We didn't have a big panel, but we had a good show. And thank you, Bill, for coming on. And you know what? Let's hope and pray that better days are coming. That's all I can say. So I'm going to wish you a good evening. Okay. And
right.
We'll be on again tomorrow night. Yeah, I got to get off. Okay, good night, everybody. Love you. God bless.
Okay.
Back to
bye
the
bye
house
now.
Now.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Cause that dawn was gone. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Talk Radio.